Welcome to the R Squared podcast. I'm your host, Ian Levy. Today's guest is Neil Payne, a staff writer for 538. Neil's here to talk about his path into data journalism and analytics writing, some of the metrics he's helped develop, sports analytics in general, and his thoughts on the Rajon Rondo trade, which was announced about an hour before we sat down to record. All right, Neil. So most of our readers, I'm sure, will be familiar with your work from 538, and a few will probably remember you also from your time at Basketball Reference. But for anybody who isn't familiar with you and your work, I'm wondering if you can sort of walk us through your background and how you got started in statistics and sports analytics.
Sure. So the real origin of all this, especially in basketball analytics, was when I was in a bookstore on vacation with my parents when I was in high school, and I just was going through the sports books, as I tended to do, and I saw this pro basketball forecast, I think is what it was called, or it may have been pro basketball prospectus even then. It was John Hollinger's book. And I had never heard of any of this. I knew about sabermetrics in baseball, and I was starting to learn about that and get into it. Moneyball had come out, and I really loved that book. But I didn't know that there was a side of it to basketball also. So when I picked up that book, I must have read it like we're at the beach, but I'm sitting inside just reading this book cover to cover and just absorbing it. And like it opened up a whole new world for me. And that was my introduction to basketball analytics, was John Hollinger, one of his first books that he put out there. And then from there, you start to learn about the stats. You get Basketball on Paper by Dean Oliver. And then I found the APBR message board, which I think at that time was a Yahoo like news group or something. It was in the very like nascent stages of its existence. And I signed up and just started talking. And it was amazing in those days you could actually interact with Dean Oliver and like John Hollinger directly. Like they didn't know me. I was just some kid. But you're on here and there's really only a handful of people on the board at that time. And so you actually got to have these like personal interactions with some of the people that would be on the Mount Rushmore of the basketball statistics, you know, in that pantheon. So from there, you know, I went to Georgia Tech. I got my degree in something that sounds made up. It's called Science, Technology, and Culture. And it was really one of the first programs that tried to blend liberal arts with like science. And in my case, I was studying econ in addition to basically having like half of my coursework being basically like an English major. So I was like reading like, you know, Victorian era literature and then building regression models the next period. And at Georgia Tech, they're very serious about engineering and serious about science. And if you're a liberal arts major, they tend to kind of look down on you because you're not really a true Georgia Tech person. And I also wondered, like, what am I going to do with this degree? This it covers things that I'm really passionate about. And I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. And I also had this newfound passion for sports statistics. And so it must have been my junior year of college, Justin Kubatko, founder of basketballreference.com, he and I had interacted a little bit on the APBR message boards, and I also helped him bounce some ideas off me about Hockey Reference when he was starting that site. Mm-hmm. Because I, you know, when you get into the sports analytics, you dive into everything that you can get on across the board, like every sport that you are passionate about. And so I'd done some stuff on hockey too. And so he asked me, he said, we're starting a blog. Would you like to do this and be our blog writer? And I said, of course I would. So I started doing that part-time, and when I graduated from tech, they had a job opening at Sports Reference, which is the parent company of Basketball Reference, Baseball Reference, and that whole family of sites. And so I was able to get the job there as their user affairs coordinator, which is basically the person that answers all of the user feedback and mail, all the little data inaccuracies that get pointed out. And believe me, there are many to deal with. It was definitely a full-time job. And so I continued doing the blogging there, and as part of working for Sports Reference, we'd go to the MIT Sloan Conference every year, just to kind of keep up on things and maybe see who we could connect with. And at one of those meetings, I met Dan Kaufman, who is an editor with ESPN Insider, and he asked me if I wanted to write some basketball columns for them under the Insider brand. And so I started doing that. And then from there, I did that for about a year and a half. And after that, Dan Rosenbaum, who I had known from back in the day, he's the sort of the public inventor of adjusted plus minus. And we can talk a little later about the lineage of some of these stats, but he was the first person to kind of reverse engineer this stat. He reached out to me and asked if I wanted to do some consulting for the Hawks. He works for them as their analytics guru. And so that's kind of how I went there. And then I went to 538 as a writer not long after that, probably about 6 months. And then that's how we end up here where I am. Looking back, I got really lucky in a lot of cases. I think you can kind of pinpoint moments where you just have these chance meetings with people, and then they turn into opportunities, and things just sort of build a path from there.
How much do you think the time you spent at Basketball Reference, and I know that this maybe wasn't your direct job, but you it seemed like you spent so much time sort of sifting through raw data and things on the back end, that sort of helped build your skill set in terms of like data management and that sort of thing.
Oh God, yeah. I think that's been hugely invaluable to me. Just from a perspective of knowing where to find everything, like if you have a data set and you need to kind of figure out, oh, well, how am I going to add things to this or update this? Or, where do I find shooting splits for, we're going to talk about Rajon Rondo tonight, probably because he got traded. But, where do I find his shooting splits from different areas of the floor? These are exactly the questions that I had to answer for people who were just fans, and in some cases, even people who worked in the front offices of teams, and they wanted to know, how can I find this on the site? And I think Baseball Reference in particular is a sprawling website and has all kinds of features and nooks and crannies that a lot of people don't even know about. And I probably don't even know about after answering people's questions, even about it for 5 years. But yeah, I think that's invaluable, just being able to work with the raw data and then also interact with these websites out there that provide the data, and knowing where to find things quickly on those sites.
So where you are now at 538, you're definitely working on narratives, So you're writing, you're doing narrative journalism supported by data, supported by statistics. How much of so if you're writing a piece, how much of your time is spent sifting through data, finding what you're looking for, collating it, making sure it matches what you expect, putting it into, tables and charts and whatever sort of visualization it's going to end up in the article, and then how much is actually, writing the text that goes with it?
Yeah, I think it's at least 50-50 between those two. And
Oh,
if I had to
really?
kind of err on the side of being conservative about it, I think I would say more time gets spent on the data than the writing, for sure. And you know this also, that you have to, when you're doing this, like I tend to think of in some of the more traditional journalism, you kind of have an idea for a narrative, and then you make some phone calls and do some stuff on the back end, and then you write your story off of that. And the data in our case is the equivalent of, tracking down the sources and, mm-hmm. and going through the journalistic process and, mm-hmm. and making your calls and things like that. And it's a very time-consuming process, especially when numbers are not always very kind to narratives, I think. That's the diplomatic way of putting it. So you have to find a way to tread that fine line between, sometimes it's interesting to have no result in the numbers from an academic perspective, but perhaps it is not interesting from a reader's perspective. So you have to find a way to make things interesting for readers while also simultaneously being true to the what the numbers are actually saying.
Yeah, and I joke around with people all the time, like for every story I publish, I've got five where I thought it was a great idea and then I spend an hour, sifting through right. things, and then it's like, oh, it's the data actually says the opposite of what I thought was happening,
Yeah.
So when you're working on a story, do you find that you often have sort of an idea first and then you go to the data to see if it matches, or do you find yourself, wandering through baseball reference, and stumbling on something interesting that then turns into a story?
I think the overwhelming majority of the time I have an idea in my head first that I want to see if the numbers prove or disprove, or maybe even there's a narrative floating around out there in the media or something that people are talking about, and I want to see, well, do the numbers actually support this? Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the best way to do it. The more scientific way to do it is it's essentially you have a hypothesis and then you're going to go test it rather than sort of dredging through the data and then saying, oh, well, this jumped out. And then, in any data set, there are going to be outliers. And if you focus on those outliers without having a reason to look for those outliers in the first place, then I think it's kind of it reverses the scientific process, and it may not be the best way to do data journalism.
In terms of the actual writing and writing narratives, how different has 538 been? The obvious difference is that you're writing about all sorts of sports, where mostly you were doing basketball writing for ESPN before. But how different is the process at 538, or the type of stuff that you're putting together?
I think the types of things are pretty similar, but I think the way to get there is very different, and you may have experienced this too. We worked with the same editor, Chad Matlin, who is fantastic. Really, one of the first things that got beaten over my head when I first started working at 538 was, don't let the process of like the numbers, like we talked about earlier, the steps that you took to come to your statistical conclusion, don't let that be the narrative. Because if you think about it, to use the traditional reporting example again, if I was writing a traditional piece, I was not going to say, oh, well, then I called this guy, and then I drove to this, gas station and met with this other guy. You're not going to say all that. And I think something that we as an analytics community could do a lot better of, and I think that's something that we're trying to do at 538, is cut out some of those, like, well, I did this, and then I ran this regression, and then this p-value was this, and so then, going through that, I think that is of interest to a very specific subset of people, but also if we're going to reach a wider audience, we can't write these things like they're academic papers or we're guiding and holding the hand of the reader through these statistical things that the reader probably actually doesn't care about. They just care that you did it properly and that you have the credibility to kind of, to trust that you did it properly. And if we need to, we'll throw the details in the footnotes. But then also they want to be told an interesting story, because in the end, that's kind of why we're all here. And I think some of the statistical jargon and the process walking through can kind of get in the way of that a lot of times.
It seems like, you know, I know there was a lot of criticism of 538, you know, right around the launch and you know, sort of as the site was getting its feet under them. And it seemed to me like some of it was complaints from people like that, maybe not recognizing that this was data journalism for a very broad audience, maybe not just people who had a lot of experience in data journalism. And so it seemed like some of the criticism was about those kinds of things, like, you know, that articles weren't sort of showing their work or fully explaining the methodology. And I know that that's a complaint, too, that I've heard maybe not specifically about methodology, but it's a complaint that I've heard too about like papers at the Sloan Conference, you know, things that are like things that are done with SportView data that's proprietary that nobody can see and nobody can double check the findings. And so, you know, you just sort of have to take it on faith. So do you feel like you know, in some ways, it seems like the work that you guys are doing at 538, you're presenting something new to both audiences. You know, so people who are not familiar with data journalism, you're presenting something new to them, and then people who are really into data and analytics, you're sort of presenting it in maybe a slightly different way than they're used to seeing it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we're kind of trying to be on the fence between these two worlds of the academic style people that are very focused on replicating the results. And I mean, we want to be transparent, and we've put some things up on GitHub, and I am guilty of not doing that enough. And if I am, it's because of just time constraints. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm cranking out one of these articles just about every day. And then putting the data set together and putting it up. But that's something that I want to be better about, because I do want people to be able to reproduce our results if they have the data, because I feel like they can. I mean, everything should be out in the open, you know, in a certain sense. But then at the same time, in the text of the article, you can't really serve that crowd of very hardcore analytics people. You also have to be open to telling something interesting to mm-hmm. people that aren't caring about reproducing the results. And mm-hmm. I think that data journalism, you know, it's a relatively new field, and we're still trying to feel our way out of how exactly do we serve both of those masters mm-hmm. at the same time. And even can you serve both of those masters at the same time? And I think lessons, certainly, I've learned a lot over the past. I mean, we only launched in March, and so it's been less than a year.
Yeah.
And I think we've all learned a lot about how to better serve each of those audiences.
One of the other things I'm really curious about with your job at 538, because it blows me away, is the idea of trying to cover all of these major sports at the same time. I mean, right. I find it difficult enough to keep up with basketball and basketball analytics. I can't imagine trying to do that and then also be, you know, an expert on baseball analytics and hockey analytics and know the statistics and the strategies to tell stories in all of those different sports. How much of a challenge is that for you?
Yeah, that is definitely a huge, huge challenge. I found that to be very challenging. I mean, I've been lucky because when I did work for Sports Reference, they have a site for all of those sports. And so you're lucky enough to learn about, you know, all the metrics and at least be able to have a conversational ability in each of those metrics. And mm-hmm. Certainly, I think I'm not the foremost expert at any of them, but if you have a level of expertise, and then another great thing about journalism is, you know, we wouldn't expect someone who is covering, you know, something in more traditional fields of journalism to necessarily be an expert about it. But the thing is, you reach out and you call experts and you talk to them and you get them to walk through things with you. And so I think that's something that's at our disposal, too, that sometimes as analysts, we might kind of not think of, it might not occur to us, and we might have this feeling of, oh, well, I have to do it all by myself, you know, and it's just me and my spreadsheet. But it's important to remember that we also have this, have the resources of other great, talented people who are experts in the specific fields at our disposal.
how much of your day, in addition to all the writing and analysis you're doing, how much of your day is reading other people's basketball work and baseball work and hockey work and whatever to sort of keep up on narratives and statistical techniques and, sort of where those things are blending?
Not enough. there just isn't enough time in the day for that stuff. I try to set aside at least like an hour or two to just kind of go through Twitter or, Tom Tango, Tango Tiger is a fantastic source, his Twitter feed of, various articles people have done across many different sports. But yeah, I think so much stuff is getting put out there right now, and it's all great for the most part that it can be mind-boggling to just handle that. And I will say I have a little bit of experience with doing that very thing when I worked with Sports Reference. We briefly ran this kind of aggregator blog type thing called Stathead, where basically I had this monstrous RSS list, this feed that I would just go through, and I had my go-to people. You were one of them, by the way.
Oh,
And
thanks.
I would just go through and pick out like whatever was written, and I would spend probably about 2 or 3 hours just going through this RSS feed and then putting together the 30 or so most interesting links that I found of the day. And you're always having to find, the new sources come out of the woodwork. And this was in 2011. So as you can imagine, it's only gotten worse now from the perspective of trying to keep up. So yeah, I think that tells you that certainly I would like to spend more time on it. And I don't know if there are enough hours in the day for one human to do that and also be able to write things of your own. So, but I think that's good though. It really talks to how our field has exploded. And I think it's just only going to get more and more great stuff out there as more people find out about this.
Do you still check up on the APBR forum? Are you still
Oh, yeah.
an active participant there?
Yeah, probably not as active as some people would like me to be. I drop in and out whenever I have like a spare second, probably about twice a week. I'll like check and see if anything is interesting going on there. And they've been having a discussion there that I want to do a feature about, and it may be part of like a ongoing NBA column, or it may be a standalone feature about like box score metrics and which one does the best job of predicting future results. And I think we're probably going to talk about this later in the show. But it's things like that, and the prediction contest. I know we put out predictions before the year, and they'll have them measured against like Vegas and other people's various predictions. And so yeah, I'll keep up with that too. But there's always, since the original version of the message board got hacked, I don't know if you remember this. It was about 3 or 4 years ago, and literally everything was lost, and some of it was recovered eventually later. Daniel Myers did a great job of trying to kind of get the archive of that back, but there was like a moment where people sort of dropped out of the conversation there, but I still feel like there are interesting conversations happening at any given moment there, even if fewer people are interacting on the boards. And fewer people are probably interacting in some ways also because a lot of the people, especially from my era of like the early days of that board, work for teams now. They're not allowed to post things willy-nilly on message board. So I think in some ways it's the brain drain phenomenon is a good thing because it measures how successful your field is, and then it also is a bad thing because we don't get to read John Hollinger anymore. We don't get to interact with Dean Oliver, things like that.
Well, we can use that the box score discussion you mentioned as a nice segue. So you have a statistical plus minus model that you developed, which we were talking earlier as maybe one of the earliest statistical plus minus models. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how that sort of captured your interest and how that metric has evolved over time.
Sure. So the first person to do anything on this that I'm aware of, and maybe even I'm wrong about this and someone did this beforehand, but Dan Rosenbaum wrote a piece. It was sort of the definitive piece in which he reverse engineered what was called WinVal, which was Wayne Winston's and Jeff Sagarin's first adjusted plus minus metric that they had done for Mark Cuban in Dallas. And this was in the late 90s. Dan Rosenbaum actually reverse engineered it and figured out that it just was this huge regression equation that tries to figure out the effect of each player after controlling for everyone else. And as part of that, he regressed his adjusted plus minus against box score stats. And I think his big motivation in that was to have essentially like a Bayesian prior or something that can like stabilize. As we know, adjusted plus minus, especially the pure adjusted plus minus that he was working with at that time, is extremely noisy. And so you have to have something that kind of grounds it. And so for him, he was using a mixture of the pure adjusted plus minus and then this statistical plus minus, which is just saying, okay, looking at the box score stats, the familiar, per minute, and you can adjust for pace or what have you, stats, which ones tend to correlate the most with a good performance while your team's on the floor versus not a good performance. And so that became kind of half or, some fraction of his plus minus model was this box score number. So I think roundabout, not long after he put that out, he got hired by a team. And David Lewin, who was his protege, and also had been known to kind of use that metric, also got hired by a team. And then it just kind of sat there, and no one really did anything with it. And at that time, WinShares had kind of just been invented by Justin Kubako, and PER was still kind of the gold standard, or it was really the most popular metric, and I don't think we really had a conception of why to use it, why not to use it. David Barry had come out with wins produced, and so there were a lot of these like linear weights, box score metrics that were floating around at that time, and there were a lot of arguments between these of like, how much weight do you give to a missed shot? Hollinger's formula famously didn't give enough weight, whereas Barry's formula gave arguably too much weight. And so there was no way to really kind of, it was just the Wild West out there at that time. And so I started thinking, like, well, we've tried all these methods where we try to intuitively come up with the value of each of these box score stats, sort of like treating basketball like it's baseball. And the long history in baseball is, well, a double is worth this number of runs, and we just throw it all together in this linear equation, and it gives us the value of the player. But in basketball, that doesn't really work. And it doesn't work because the players are actually interacting with each other, and the stats don't, they don't belong to the individual that put them up necessarily. And some of the stats belong to the player more than others. And so, like defensive rebounds, as we would later kind of find out, are hugely a function of your role on the team. And you can actually steal defensive rebounds from your own teammates because
Lance Stephenson.
Exactly. Yeah. Because of coaching philosophies or just playing style. So you're not actually. A lot of those linear weights models thought that, oh, well, the marginal value of one defensive rebound is this number of scoreboard points, but it's not really true, and it changes depending on what you're doing on in the other areas of the box score. So I thought, well, the only real way that we can kind of suss out any kind of linear weights for basketball stats is not to think through these thought experiments in our heads and try to come up with these discrete point values for each event. We have to look at what correlates with playing well when you're on the floor, because that's sort of the only unbiased measurement of how good a basketball player that you are that we have. So it turns out that is exactly what Dan Rosenbaum had done years before when he did the statistical plus minus model. So I kind of came across that and was like, hey, This is fantastic. So originally, I just used his formula, which was trained on the 2004 season, I think it was. And then I was like, well, a lot more people are computing adjusted plus minus, and we're having more data than ever. So why settle for that? Why not just make my own model? So I started doing that. And then I just kind of like left it for a while, and just kind of, I don't think it's the be all and end all of stats for sure. But I think among box score stats, it does do a really good job of predicting what a future lineup will do. Like if you have a bunch of guys, like a 5-man unit, for instance, of guys who are good in, say, PER, okay, well, if PER is really worth its salt as a stat, then you would expect that 5-man unit that you aggregated of guys who are good in PER to do well. But if you actually look at and measure the stats that way and say, well, which ones are the best predictors of these performances when you aggregate guys who are good or bad in the stats, PER is not good. And wins produced is even worse. And win shares is not really that good either. And it turns out that these statistical plus minus models, and I know Daniel Myers has even gone beyond what I did with his advanced statistical plus minus, which I guess is now called box plus minus. And they just added it to Basketball Reference. Those metrics really do a better job of predicting how these units and these teams that are formed from players with these pre-existing statistics will do when you actually put them on the floor and say, okay, go, play against this other team and we'll see which one actually predicts the best. So that to me is sort of the best way to test whether a stat is, doing its job or not. And it turns out that these statistical plus minus ones seem to do a markedly better job than some of the other more well-known box score based stats, at least.
With the statistical plus minus models, is there an attraction to you in yours and some of the other ones that they're, it seems like they're more transparent than some of the other adjusted plus minus models or Jeremias Engelman's stuff, real plus minus is sort of a black box and RAPM and stuff like that, that anybody can sort of look at the coefficients and sort of see how it's put together.
Yeah, I think you have to kind of it's a spectrum, right? Where probably the most transparent metrics of all are like PER and even like wins produced, where they were like, oh, well, he got a rebound, and a rebound is worth this number of points, and it's this number of points because in Hollinger's case, because it seems like it should be, and in the case of Barry, because when I ran this regression on teams wins, this is what it spat out. So in a certain sense, those are more transparent because if you start to look at the statistical plus minus models, they'll sometimes give you counterintuitive coefficients where we'll say, oh, well, steals are really valuable on offense too because it's not looking for the actual value of the particular event anymore. It's actually just looking to say, okay, players who produce a lot of this stat in the box score tend to also be good or bad in some cases at adjusted plus minus, or in essence, making their teams play better when they're on the floor. So, in a certain sense, you're actually just using the box score metrics as proxies for various different skills and skill sets that translate or don't translate to making the team play better. And then at the far other end of the spectrum of transparency, in a certain sense, is the adjusted plus minus models where, you can't explain why certain players have certain ratings except that, well, the team did better when he was on the floor after controlling for teammates, opponents, coaching, and home court advantage. So, therefore, he is a good player. In a certain sense, it's tautological because he's a good player because he has a good plus minus, and he has a good plus minus because he's a good player. And definitionally, it makes sense because the best basketball player is the player that's most associated with his team doing better when he's on the floor, if you were able to perfectly account for all these other factors. But at the same time, I think it can be frustrating to people to see like Nick Collison rated as the fifth best player in basketball, according to some of the adjusted plus minus models. And it's like, well, why? Why is this happening? And you can't really say. So I think probably statistical plus minus does a good job of splitting those. I mean, I still would use something like real plus minus. I think it's by far the best at some of those tests that we talked about earlier of like predicting how well a unit will do when you don't know anything else about it except how it performed in that stat previously, how the individuals did. And it also has a statistical plus minus backbone to it. Jerry Engelman ran his own regression on it, and he even took it further with some controversial decisions for some members of the APBR metrics board of like including height and age and a lot of things that go beyond even looking at the player's box score stats, but actually in a certain sense, like they describe external factors about the player, you know, beyond their performance. So you can go a lot of different directions with it. And I think a good balance can be struck with statistical plus minus, even if it's not necessarily the best one at predicting.
So one of the things we've been talking about a lot at Nylon Calculus lately is all of these, I suppose we've been mostly talking about plus minus models, both statistical and real plus minus. And the way that they sort of lend themselves to misunderstandings, the way that they by boiling a player's contributions down to a single number, they lend themselves to ignorance of context, and that they sort of that there's always this danger that they end up as player rankings, you know. So the article that I did for 538 a couple weeks ago, I got a bunch of comments about Patty Mills was ranked in like the 88th percentile, and he was ahead of John Wall and Kyrie Irving and a couple other players, and I got a lot of comments about did I really think Patty Mills was better than those players. And so I wrote a little thing for Nylon Calculus. My answer was, no, I don't think he's better than those players, but I don't think statistical plus minus is saying that he's better than those players. It's saying that in that role, in that team context with the Spurs, he performed better than John Wall did in his greatly expanded role. Those kinds of sort of contextual pieces are not readily apparent, and if people aren't looking for them, they can get ignored.
Oh yeah, I think you have to kind of be wary of anything that tries to boil a player's contribution or talent. We all like to kind of use these numbers as a proxy for the player's basketball talent. Whatever that even means, as we were talking about earlier, does it mean that he makes the team play better? Well, you know, does he make the team play better only in a very specific role? Like a Dennis Rodman made his teams play much better, but it was within this role that you had to have the rest of the roster be almost like perfectly tailor-made to accommodate this guy that isn't going to try to score. He's going to try to grab every rebound possible. And, you know, you have to be able to work around that. And the question of, you know, his value changes depending on what situation you put him in. And then the other thing with Patrick Mills is, I mean, even if you looked at like PER or win shares, he probably had high numbers. I mean, he had a 59 true shooting percentage last year. Like, I think in a lot of cases, some of the comments were confusing, like having one great outlier year with being great. Like this was by far the best year of his career. Whereas some of the other players that he was, oh, do you really think he's better than John Wall or whatever? Those players had more of a track record, far more of a track record than Mills having this one spectacular year. So, you know, this happens. It's another thing that happens a lot in baseball where a player will have, you know, a fantastic offensive season that's completely like Chris Davis, for instance, 2 years ago with the Orioles. And it's totally out of step with his preceding seasons and, the season that he had last year even, and it will probably go down as the best year of his career. No one bats an eye when a guy has that kind of season at the plate.
Mm-hmm.
But then when a number suggests that a player has like a certain, I think it was Alex Gordon had like an aberrantly high fielding rating in WAR
mm-hmm.
this past season, and people jumped on that and were like, well, this is why WAR is wrong. It involves mm-hmm. defense too much, and this metric can't be right. It puts mm-hmm. this one particular outlier season. But why are defensive players not allowed to have outliers also?
Mm-hmm.
And some of it goes to what we were talking about earlier with black boxes, where we can look and see what caused Chris Davis to have an outlier offensive season in 2013. Well, he hit 50, 60 home runs and had this number of, had this on-base percentage and all this. And we trust those numbers, and they've been around for a long time. And we can look and kind of piece together, oh, well, this is why he had this. And you know, mm-hmm. this park adjustment makes a little difference. But mainly it's the familiar stats that we know and love. But then when we look at Alex Gordon's fielding, it comes from like Baseball Info Solutions have these like graders that like sit and watch every clip of every game, and they map the trajectory of the ball and then say, well, when a ball is hit to this location with this trajectory, there's a certain probability of it turning into an out. So when he turns it into an out, he's added this number of outs, and then we translate that to runs. And so compared to the average outfielder, he has this number of saved runs. And it's just, I think, to all but like 5% of the people who are following baseball, if that many, it's like, I don't care about that. Like, yeah. This number makes no sense to me. And you know what? It might actually be true. Like, if you sat down and actually had the numbers, or you sat down and watched all the video clips of Alex Gordon playing in the outfield, you'd be like, oh, well, he actually did get to a lot of balls that were impressive and, turned a lot of balls into outs that shouldn't have. So it kind of makes sense, but no one really takes the time to do that, and there's no familiar groundwork laid underneath that allows you to say, oh, well, this is why this happened. And I think the same thing happens a lot in some of the basketball stats that involve plus minus is, yeah, if you watched every shift that Nick Collison played on the floor, you would notice, whoa. But then you'd also have to watch every shift in which he doesn't play on the floor, and then try to like mentally try to figure out, oh, well, he was on the floor and Westbrook was in this case, but then wasn't in this other one. And then now I'm going to compare him to Perkins in this other situation. And it adds up really quickly. And there's a reason why regression formulas have to be called into this, and do the job that humans can't do. But I think we have a lot of trouble when we see a result and we can't readily explain it, even if it turns out to be perfectly valid. And mm-hmm. that goes to what you were saying earlier about this idea of like black box stats.
Yeah. So I want to make sure we have time to actually talk about a little bit of basketball, but we have one more thing in your background that I wanted to make sure we touched on was, because you had done some consulting for the Atlanta Hawks and are no longer with them, we talked earlier and you said you're able to discuss some things about that experience. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what that experience was like. And I know one of the things that's interesting to me is that how you felt like your analysis was received by the organization, because there's sort of this perception that still in, everywhere except maybe the Mavs and the Rockets, that they're still sort of jocks and nerds, and that part of the savvy analyst job is convincing, convincing the decision makers to buy, to buy into stats. And so I'm wondering if that was a part of the experience at all for you.
Well, I think that's always going to be the experience. Even if you were a scout, for instance, and you didn't even use stats, you'd have to figure out a way to convince the people who are ahead of you on the organizational depth chart to buy into what you're saying, especially if what you're saying is counterintuitive, as a lot of the stuff that we uncover with stats tends to be, or has the possibility of being. But as for my experience, though, I found that the Hawks front office was extremely receptive to input from, you know, myself and Dan Rosenbaum, and we even had some people who were like interns that were working on various projects. And we would sit in the room and our voices would be heard. Now, you know, did they always make decisions purely on the basis of the stats? No. But I felt like they were given an audience, and Dan is someone that is so respected that you know, people listen to him, and he has a great long history with he had it with Danny Ferry, and then now Wes Wilcox, who is sort of the acting GM, from what I've heard, of the team, that he has a long history of working with Dan Rosenbaum. And so there's this good relationship between the stats people. And I don't know if that's the case in a lot of other front offices, but from my perspective, and really the vast overwhelming majority of my interactions with them and my time there were just through like email, where I would get a project that I needed to work on, or I needed to program something to help the coaches pull a particular stat quicker off of something like Basketball Reference, in some cases, or some of the NBA, you know, .com stat sites. And so the I found that experience to be sort of what you would expect, like, of any data analyst in any field. Like, you get asked to do a project and then you do it. And probably once every month or two, I would go down to Atlanta, and I would be greeted very warmly and get to spend a day or two with the basketball ops people. And, you know, we would rate players and we would, you know, watch practices and things like that. And everyone was equally welcome. And as long as you were a member of the front office, it didn't matter if you were, you know, viewed as like a stat head or a scout. And all the scouts were also very open to, you know, our interpretation of the stats and kind of learning about the stats. So I think I was in a very great situation, and I hope other situations are just as good, but I found it to be really enlightened front office.
That's refreshing to hear, because I feel like that's definitely not the perception of the norm. But all right, so 45 minutes in, we're going to swing to actual basketball. Rajon Rondo traded tonight. The last look we had at the deal was Rondo going to the Mavericks, Brandon Wright, Jay Crowder, Jameer Nelson, and I think you said a first and a second headed back to Boston.
That was what I was seeing at the time. they were saying that it was close to being finalized or nearly finished, so I don't know if that's set in stone. Okay. Yeah, so it looks like they'll get a 2015 first rounder, the Celtics will, and then a 2016 second rounder in addition to Wright, Crowder, and Nelson.
So what's your perception there?
I mean, that seems like quite a haul for Rondo. Rondo's fascinating because even amongst stat heads, forget like scouts versus stats or whatever kind of dichotomy that you want, but even within our community, I don't think there's a consensus of how good he is, especially since he has played so differently depending on, like, obviously you're going to play better when you're surrounded by three or four Hall of Famers, but at the same time, his level of play, and he's had the injuries, he can't stay healthy, it's really fallen off in recent years. And everything that people always, the book on him about, like, oh well, you just play off him, make him shoot, don't let him drive. If you look at the numbers, I mean, it sort of bears out that conclusion. Like, his free throw rate is almost half of what it used to be during his salad days of like 2009 and 2010. And then at the same time, he's shooting like, look at this. So in 2015, granted it's 22 games, he is shooting 10 percentage points lower on two-pointers than he did in 2010. Jeez. And that's going to like destroy your efficiency no matter who you are, especially if you're predicated on attacking the basket. So he does a lot of great things and he does a lot of frustrating things. And I think this sort of goes back to our discussion earlier of like, how do you process that in one number? I don't know if it's possible. You have to probably bring in the scouts and say, okay, well, what situation do you think that in our situation that he would be able to thrive, and look at like why he was thriving when he was actually, you know, playing well earlier.
So, do you think he's another guy like Rodman that you mentioned earlier, where he can be super successful and super productive, but it has to be a very specific context and sort of tailored around what he does and won't do?
It wouldn't surprise me because he is probably one of the most unique players just in terms of like the various different combination of stats that he has. He's like very versatile, but he doesn't score and he can't shoot, but he has these insanely high assist numbers. Like, unique players tend to break some of our beloved models, I think, at the extremes. And Rodman was certainly one of those. And it wouldn't surprise me if Rondo is also in that boat.
Do you have any thoughts on Brandon Wright? I know he's been huge for the Mavericks this year, and it seems like not having him to soak up minutes behind Chandler could be a big problem for them.
Yeah, well, Brandon Wright is kind of another interesting longtime case of the numbers tend to say this guy is fantastic, especially if you look at his like win shares and I'm sure his wins produced were off the charts. And the counter to that is always, yeah, well, it's easy for him to do that when he's playing, 25 minutes a game and he is, has this usage that's low. Like his offensive rating, if you just look at it, the Dean Oliver metric over the last 4 years. So in 2012, it was 125. And remember, the league average is like 106 around there. In 2013, it was 119. But then he was just starting to get warmed up because last year it was 135. And so far this year, it's been 149.
Jeez.
Which has to, I would think, I mean, I know Steve Kerr and Fred Hoiberg have had some, and Tyson Chandler had some notably high seasons in my memory, but 149 has to be like one of the highest offensive ratings I've ever seen. And he's doing it on like 14.6% of the possessions while he's on the floor. So he's that classic guy that like you're not running plays for. He's rebounding a lot and he's just getting some frankly easy opportunities, and he's taking advantage of them. And so, depending on how you value usage, how you value assist, like his assist numbers are absolutely microscopic. And then how you also look at defense is going to depend on his whole perception as a player is going to depend on which of those categories you put weight on.
One other thing I wanted to touch base on was the real plus or the season preview projections you did at 538, which were based on real plus minus. In the Western Conference, you had the Warriors at the best as the best team, and we had Nathan Walker at Nylon Calculus also did a set of real plus minus based projections, and he had the Warriors on top too. And I think I just looked before we sat down. I think he had the Warriors at 56 wins, and they're on a trajectory to obliterate that.
Yes.
And so what is it, what did Real Plus Minus like about the Warriors coming into this season, and where have they been even better than expected?
Well, I think they just had a lot of players who do really well on that stat. And Iguodala, some of that was kind of a residual from what he had done in the past, more than recent years. But, it saw him playing a big role, and it saw, Klay Thompson shows up as better in real plus minus probably than any other metric, especially before this year. Now it's kind of caught up. But he was someone that, because it takes into account defense, that metric was kind of in on the ground floor on. It always has loved Bogut. It likes Lee, and he hasn't even played for them, so imagine how scary. But Draymond Green is a guy that metric loves. So I think it was just this aggregation of a lot of guys. And when we think about the Warriors, we think about the great offense of Steph Curry, and that he sort of defines that team as he should. I mean, he's the one of the best players in the league. And when we think about Curry, we think, oh, well, he has to have Klay as kind of this defensive bodyguard to sort of take the pressure off him and match up with the best opposing perimeter player. So he has to be hidden. And defensively, that means if your best player is bad defensively, then you as a team must not be that good defensively. But the Warriors were actually really good defensively last year. And then this year, they've been the best defensive team in the league. And you know, are shaping up to have one of the best defensive seasons, if they keep it up, relative to league average of like all time. Mm-hmm. So it was actually the offense that was trailing, which was an indictment of Mark Jackson as much as anything, but also this sort of very counterintuitive result that if you adjust for pace and look at the per possession stats, then they're actually not that good offensively. And they've gotten a little better this year. And I think that's probably the biggest thing for them, was they made that leap from average offensively to pretty decent, you know, like good offensively. They're still not great. Mm-hmm. And then that coupled with having a defense that has gotten better and might tail off, you know, depending on whether you think the projections are, you know, they're outstripping their projections too much. But I think a little marginal improvement on offense and then just kind of keeping a really good defense has made them great. And something like Real Plus Minus can kind of pick up on that probably before some of the other metrics that don't measure defense as well do. Mm-hmm.
So do you think, maybe stats aside, do you think the Warriors are the best team in the league? And do you think they're, would you call them a championship favorite?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're the favorites right now, and I think they're the best team. I think, as we saw with the Memphis game the other night, I mean, there's plenty of other teams out there also that can give them trouble on any given night. You know, not to read, you know, a lot of people were like falling all over themselves after that game and like, oh, well, this has proven that the Warriors can't deal with Memphis's, size, you know, like size and toughness and all this stuff. You know, let's not get ahead of ourselves. You know, it's one game out of 82, but, I think they probably should be the favorites. Certainly Cleveland is starting to get it together, and Cleveland were our favorites before the season. Only, we didn't think they were the best team, but we thought they were the team that had the highest chance of winning because the East is just such a top-heavy, like, you know, it's a tire fire once you get below a certain level. But then even that has proven to be a little bit inaccurate, because there are some teams like my former employers even that have done a lot better than people expected. So it's not as much of a one or two team race as it seemed like it was going to be before the season.
So taking up a lot of your evening, but before we let you go, I find myself asking this question to people when they're on the podcast for the first time. I'm always really curious about how people watch games and what people are focused on, what people are thinking about when they watch games. So when you're watching a game, are you thinking about stats? Are stats sort of whether you're looking at stuff on the computer or whether you're just sort of, you know, intuiting that in your thought process? Are stats part of the watching experience, or do you sort of watch the game and then go look at the statistics later?
I think they are part of the watching experience from a, like, you know, I have my priors before I, spoken like a true Bayesian, before I go into a game, and I have my ideas of like, okay, well, you know, this, especially in defense, I tend to do a lot of like off ball watching when I watch a game. And so I want to like know, and even something like synergy is pretty good for this, of like, okay, well, how good is this guy in the pick and roll according to the numbers? And then you kind of watch it and see, oh, well, this played out. That was true, or, you know, it didn't. And so I think about it beforehand, but then I'm not thinking during the game, oh my God, Brandon Wright's offensive rating in this game is, you know, so high. Like, I tend to not think about the particular stats from the game itself until maybe like halftime, when it, or when there's like a break and it's like, oh, the Sixers are shooting 30% from the floor. That's not really weird, but it's terrible. And so, you know, like, you don't notice those things within the flow of the game. But I statistically, I think my priors for watching have been informed by it more than actually paying attention to the stats once the game gets started.
Gotcha. Well, Neil, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk tonight. It was a lot of fun, and we'll keep reading you on 538, and we'll make sure we put a link to your author archive and your Twitter handle in the show notes. So,
well, thank you for having me. By the way, this was great, and yeah, I'd be happy to come back anytime.
All right, sounds great. Thanks a lot.